Welcome back. You're watching Stockwatch with me, Julieta Talevi, and joining me to take your questions this evening are Nick Crail from F&B Wealth and Investments and Shane Watkins from All Weather Capital. If you'd like to send questions to us, please SMS 41392, email stockwatch@bdtv.co.za or tweet us at BusinessDayTV using the hashtag Stockwatch. And Nick, Shane, good evening to you both. Nice to see you there. Shane, let me start with you. The markets were a little bit peaky today. But there was a recovery in the Chinese stock market, which I think got everyone a bit nervous yesterday as a result of all the protests and the demonstrations that took place around various Chinese cities over the weekend. And the expectations somehow seeming to be that, yes, they are going to open up the economy. And then I saw an FT article this afternoon where Beijing essentially says, nope, they're not deviating from their zero COVID approach. So I wonder if that rally in the markets was premature, especially if you consider what's happening to U.S. markets at the moment, which is not very much. In other words, they, I think, are taking a more circumspect view.
So, you know, look, Chinese equities have come off, you know, very significantly this year, kind of 30 to 60% down. And this being characterized also by a lot of volatility. So you do have days where things are down or up 5 or 10%. They were up, overnight. In anticipation, as you said, of a relaxation of the zero COVID policy. Juliet, the problem is that Xi Jinping has aligned himself so directly and personally with the zero COVID policy that any step back from the policy would be kind of an embarrassment to him. So, you know, it's hard to see him stepping back from that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some conspiracy theorists out there believe that, you know, to some degree he allowed these protests simply so that his intelligence apparatus could identify who the real troublemakers were photographically on video in the Chinese environment, so that in a subsequent crackdown he knows who to go after. Mm. Of course, I don't know if that's true, but I do think it's fair to say that, you know, we're going into winter in China. Today was one of the highest COVID cases that they've announced currently. Their vaccines have not been effective, or less effective certainly than Western vaccines. And less than 20% of the aged population is vaccinated, versus in Western countries, over 80% is vaccinated. So I guess, you know, short story, it's hard to see them relaxing the zero COVID policy now.
Yeah. I mean, Nick, Bloomberg came out with some scathing editorials this morning about Xi Jinping and how he's effectively snookered himself. And just talking how, you know, this authoritarianism is not going to end well, but who knows how, when, you know, that might play out. I mean, for you, are a lot of Chinese shares sort of uninvestable? That was the worry, certainly a few months ago. And then there was some expectation that, no, it's not, you know, there's going to be a bit of a relaxation, the crackdown on tech companies in particular. You know, they've taken their sort of iron grip off that a little bit. But given what you've seen in the last couple of days, what's your sentiment towards Chinese equities?
Yes, I don't mind Chinese equities, to be honest. I think you've got to have a fairly high appetite for risk to get into that at the moment. And I certainly think that, you know, just from a geopolitical kind of, standpoint, the appetite for global investors to invest in China, I think that, especially in the Western world, I think they look at it as pretty close to uninvestable. Mm. And that really sort of talks through to Shane's points around the sort of volatility you see in the stocks. It is very much underappreciated and I think underowned, currently. And in those sort of scenarios, I think positioning being as bearish as it is means that any sort of vague rumors, as you sort of alluded to, you know, surrounding perhaps a, you know, relaxation in restrictions around COVID, et cetera, are going to get the market a little bit excited because it has taken such a sort of hard beating. I think that China is a significant country. I think it's got a significant population. I think it is still on a growth trajectory, just not the growth that they've gotten used to perhaps over the last 20 years. Yeah. So there's a lot of opportunity, but they're certainly in the eye of the storm at the moment. Add to that then the geopolitical risks, and I think you have a lot of investors saying, no, I'll sit on the sidelines until I get a bit more certainty. And unfortunately, that's almost characterized where we sit in the world, where everyone's a little bit negative, a little bit bearish, and yet no one really has certainty about the sort of I suppose potentially the depth of risk, the recession that we might be entering into, at least in, let's say, the developed economies, and whether inflation is going to come down, at what pace, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of uncertainty at the moment with a lot of pessimism. Mm-hmm. And it's making, you know, shorter term investment decisions quite tough to navigate in this sort of environment.
Yeah. Okay, well, then let's hang on. Shane.
Maybe just to add, I just wanted to add to what Nick was saying, you know, so the zero COVID policy is very much looking at the domestic dimension of how things are playing out in China. But there's also the global dimension, which really relates to their relationship with the United States. Now, the one country that has benefited over the last two or three decades of globalization more than anyone has been China. And I think the U.S. and China are now increasingly realizing that they are serious strategic global competitors. And it's, to some degree, there's a bit of a zero-sum game playing out. And there's some regulation going through in the United States over the next couple of months that will determine to some degree how the relationship plays out. The one is what they call the Holding Foreign Companies Accountable Act, which is essentially American companies wanting Chinese companies to comply with U.S. GAAP. And the American regulators having access to the audit packs of Chinese companies, which the Chinese have resisted. And then the other one is the Taiwan Policy Act, which is essentially the Americans putting into law the extent to which they will protect Taiwan in some way. And so those are two additional kind of wrinkles in the future for China. In particular, you know, if they are not successful in getting through and complying with U.S. GAAP, there's a risk that Chinese companies that are listed in the United States will be delisted. And, of course, if the Americans have a kind of draconian Taiwan Policy Act, you know, implemented, and that seems more likely now that the Republicans have gained greater power in the recent midterms, then the Chinese could respond with further kind of measures of their own. So, you know, in this kind of geopolitical conflict, they're not really, it's not really a good environment for equities generally.
Yeah, I think wrinkle is a sort of a nice euphemistic way of putting it. What might transpire in the next few months? Okay, so you have, but you still sound as if you have slightly different views. Nick, you sound like you might be keen to take a bit of risk on certain companies. Shane, it sounds like you're kind of staying away entirely. I don't know if that's the correct assessment that I've got here from the both of you. But I shall move on, okay? Because it's hard to talk about unknowable things. So let's talk about things that we do know. And there are two questions this evening about Mr. Price. You've had results out from Mr. Price last week. You had results out from Pepco. You've had Fashini. And the questions are, is there any hope for Mr. Price? It's now approaching its 52-week low. And the other one is, well, yeah, it's down to its lows of the year. Is the stock just cheap, or should I be on the sidelines? Nick, the market's all of a sudden taking a lot more of a jaundiced approach, but I suppose the results weren't great. I mean, let's be honest.
No, so, certainly a company that is facing some challenges at the moment. But I think, you know, to the viewer's question, is it cheap or do you stay on the sidelines? And my view is it's cheap. Again, it comes, I suppose, down to your time frame for when you're going to make that return. And certainly with the world it is at the moment, you know, negatively looking at perhaps economic slowdowns, harsh realities, high inflation, you know, quite a bearish kind of outlook in terms of, let's say, the next 12 to 18 months. You know, not any sort of apparel retailer is going to do particularly well in that environment. And I think that's largely being priced into the sector as a whole. Okay. And so if you've got a six-month opportunity, perhaps you do want to stay on the sort of the sidelines. If you've got a longer investment time frame, I think, you know, the strategic initiatives that Mr. Price is moving toward, their balance sheet strength, et cetera, is going to keep them afloat during these sort of more, let's say, difficult times. And, you know, the sun will come out, and when it does, I think they're going to be ideally positioned. And I think the shares will reprice and reprice quite aggressively. So as a long-term investor, I think it's a good entry point.
Yeah. I mean, Mr. Mark Blair was saying to my colleague Adele Cheville, that they're still very optimistic. I suppose, you know, you have to say that as the CEO, but he was also, the point he was making, because we were asking about the shift, you know, there was this rush into the retailers that have attacked the so-called value segment, and there was this expectation that they were going to do the best, but unfortunately their customers are being particularly hard hit by the ravages of inflation, so high food, high fuel costs, that's starting to eat into their disposable income, whereas if your upper income, it's not quite so bad. And you're saying, well, we can move into the upper segments, whereas, you know, it's not a one-way street. But Shane, I don't know if you have a similar view to Nick, or if you're more bearish altogether on the Mr. Prices or Pepcors or the value retailers of the JSE.
So, Nicolette, you know, I think if you look at this through a longer-term lens, sort of a secular lens, and then sort of a more seasonal short-term lens, the longer-term lens of these apparel retailers is that for 25 years they've been feeding off Edgar's for market share. Okay, if you go back to 1995, Edgar's had 38.5% of the South African apparel market, and that has dwindled down to, like, let's call it high single digits. And so it's been easy to grow while you have been attacking a bleeding massive competitor. And to some degree, that game has played out. So I'm talking, that's the longer term perspective of the apparel retailers. Their ability to gain market share without killing each other, merely going after Edgar's, has been a 20-year story that's been very beneficial. So that's over, more or less. The shorter term story for the retailers, as Nick said, you know, I think we know the economy is in a tougher space. And, you know, the kind of most simple way to understand an apparel retailer's results is to look at what the like-for-like sales are. Don't look at the actual numbers. Just look at what the actual like-for-likes are. Assuming, say, the stores didn't grow, look what this turnover was. And to a large degree, the like-for-likes have slowed or, in some cases, gone negative. Hmm. And that would be at a revenue line. But if you take inflation into account, volumes are well down.
Yeah.
So actual apparel volumes are down 5 to 10%, the number of garments they're selling. So, you know, but costs, on the other hand, like-for-like costs are going up. So you have these, your revenue moving on a like-for-like basis downwards and your costs moving on a like-for-like basis upwards. So that's not really a good cocktail for earnings. And some of these shares are still quite expensive. So I think, you know, we want to be choosy in that sector because I don't think all companies are going to do equally well.
Okay. Nick, just your thoughts on credit versus cash retailers into the next financial year. I mean, there seem to be very differing schools of thought that you would rather buy the credit retailers that maybe target the upper income customer rather than the Pepcors or Mr. Prices. But on the other hand, you have these interest rate hikes, which we've had, 325 basis points this year alone, and it doesn't seem like it's going to stop. The hawks at the inflation at the Reserve Bank are well in charge. I mean, are you quite nervous about what that'll do to credit retailers specifically?
Yes, I am fairly nervous, quite simply. I mean, I would certainly prefer, I think in these sort of times when you're looking at battening down the hatches, and if you're going to go into a, you know, fairly cyclical space, which fashion sort of apparel is, or apparel retailers are, then you would prefer the ones with the least sort of cyclicality. And I think credit often, you know, especially in a bearish type of environment, and let's say that plays out, then it is the credit retailers that, you know, potentially could be hit fairly hard. Mm-hmm. Again, it's all about timing your entry and exit points to these sorts of things, because as they get hard, they'll make, you know, significant provisions, and ultimately it'll probably not be as bad as that they will, you know, provide for, and inevitably, you know, there will be provision releases later on, as we have seen, you know, through COVID, et cetera, et cetera. But certainly at this time in the cycle, I'll prefer cash.
Shane, your view?
So, look, you know, the credit retailers also benefit from rising rates, because as interest rates rise, as the Reserve Bank announces a rate hike, the credit retailers immediately reprice the credit that they have sold into their own customer base. So their book becomes more valuable. Hmm. The offsetting factor is that there can be higher bad debts. But generally, the benefit of the higher interest earned tends to overshadow the higher bad debts. And I think the credit retailers have got better at managing that cyclicality with much better systems over time. Hmm. So I would differ a little bit with Nick. I think, you know, if you look at the results from Lewis, they were extremely good. They credit furniture. I thought the TFG results were okay. The Truist results were actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. And all of these are credit retailers, big credit books. And provided interest rates don't go too high, there's actually a benefit to them because they're basically like banks. They're banks that only lend to people to buy clothes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, two different points of view, extremely well argued. So I'd be sitting here, I think I wouldn't buy any retailers whatsoever because I don't know what to do at this point. What about Carp Agri? Let's go slightly left field in the retail sector. And the question is, what's the view of the panel on Carp Agri as a medium-term buy in a portfolio, or is Omnia a better buy at the moment? Nick, is Carp Agri one that you look at? They've been sort of incrementally doing their thing, seem to be doing quite well.
Yes, I think that it's a well-managed business. I think it's pretty good. It's not really in a sector that I enjoy too much as a whole. So, you know, from my side, I would prefer Omnia, who's obviously had a very difficult, let's say, last 8 years, ultimately sort of recovering and getting kind of better. I think they've got a couple of different arrows in their quiver that they can sort of shoot out and look at in the market. They're going to be a little bit less cyclical than I expect Calgary to be. From my side, it would be preferring Omnia at this point.
Yeah, and also I suppose Omnia has kind of proven themselves under management over the last 3 years that they didn't stuff it up with the rights issue. They actually did what they set out to do, which is quite commendable. Shane, do you look at Carp Agri at all? I mean, I know my colleague Mark Hassenfuss wrote about, you've got the sort of the AgriMark aspect of the business, which has quite nice margins. I think they're above 6%. But then you've got the fuel business, which has very skinny margins. And I wonder if that's the problem for a lot of investors.
So, you know, the history of Carp Agri, obviously it was a PSG group company. PSG unbundled it. And it was very much historically a Western Cape kind of cooperative with stores that sold produce to farmers or product, farming equipment, not heavy equipment like tractors or harvesters, but light equipment.
Yeah.
And they then found that they had all of these sites where they were selling diesel, and those sites were essentially licensed as filling stations. And they then suddenly realized that they could roll out filling stations, all over their premises because they were already licensed for it. So there are two components of the business, as you say. It's a retail component and a fuel component. Like any business, they will do well when their clients are doing well. And yeah. Right now, the farmers in the Western Cape are doing reasonably well. We've had quite good rains. And so I think it's actually a very good business. I mean, it trades on sort of a high single-digit PE. Sort of 8 or 9 times forward, maybe even slightly less than that. And I think it's a pretty good little business. The returns have been quite low, the returns on assets and returns on equity, but management have been kind of working to get those up. And as your ROE goes up, you should expect the PE ratio to go up as well.
Okay.
So yeah, I think it's a pretty good business. It differs a little bit from Omnia, which is basically a fertilizer business. Fertilizer companies they initially did quite well because, I don't know, I think like at least a third of the world's potash came from Ukraine, and obviously that stopped coming, because of the war. So fertilizer prices went up. More recently, the fertilizer companies have done less well. But I would agree with Nick. I mean, I think Omnia is it's a very well-managed company now. I mean, 5 years ago, I would say there was a risk of bankruptcy, but I'd say, now I think it's actually under new management, the guys have done a very good job.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, some things to chew over there. Then a question on Glencore. What's the panel's view? Could there be another major stock market crash next year? As suggested by Michael Burry. Nick? Well, I suppose there's always the odds of a stock market crash. Would it take Glencore with it?
So I suppose if we go back to 2016, the sort of the lows of the commodity markets, Glencore certainly faced some liquidity challenges in terms of its balance sheet at that sort of point. And so in a turndown and a significant sort of stern down for commodity prices, suddenly they did find themselves between a rock and a hard place. I think for all commodity companies, really, At the moment, times are very different at the moment, so there's a lot of balance sheet strength. That doesn't mean that the share prices can't take a bit of a beating, as they'll be linked through to commodity prices in general, but I think they will remain solvent. Or the chances of that are very high at this sort of point. Glencore is obviously currently making a lot of free cash flow, going to be paying it out to investors as well, is fairly attractively priced, obviously continues, you know, being in the press for the wrong reasons with regards to settling corruption claims, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got to have appetite for an asset like that if one's having a look at Glencore. But the commodity mix is certainly quite good. A company I like in terms of the commodity mix, and the pricing is not too aggressive at the moment. So it's a company I would keep an eye on.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually had a phenomenal year compared to some of its peers. Michael Burry, I thought that name was familiar. He was... Scion Capital, wasn't it? He sort of made famous by The Big Short, Michael Lewis's book, where he bet against the subprime market and was ridiculed, and did very well out of it. Shane, do you think he's on the money? I mean, and well, firstly, and then your thoughts on Glencore? It's had a very good run this year.
Well, maybe just to follow on what Nick said about Glencore. I mean, you know, so the answer to any commodity company is what's happening in China, right? 70% of all the seaborne iron ore goes to China. 50% of the world's copper goes to China, and about a third of everything else. So if you want to know, if you have a definite view on China, then you can have a definite view on commodity companies. So, you know, having said that, I mean, the reason people want the zero COVID policy to come to an end is they want the Chinese economy to open up, they want the Chinese economy to grow, and they want the Chinese economy to, you know, restart or accelerate the buying of iron ore, coal, steel, copper, PGMs, and whatever. So, you know, if you see those signs in China, then that's going to be good news for the diversified miners. On Glencore specifically, I mean, the business, They've both kept their coal assets, which have obviously done extremely well. I mean, I think they've signed contracts north of $350 a ton, which is unbelievable. And at the same time, they've started to invest into battery group metals. So they're using the cash flow from their kind of old economy businesses to buy into new economy businesses. And I think they are quite an entrepreneurial, inventive management team in relation to other mining companies. And as you say, the share has done very well. I think it's up 40-50% this year. And I guess it would be a good holding in a long-term portfolio.
Okay. Yes. Right. Well, I'm going to move on. There was a question on Thungela, but unfortunately, I'd rather get to your stock picks, so apologies to the viewer. Nick, what interests you at this point?
So I suppose with the round coming back, as it has somewhat, I'm going to look for investments offshore. Again, I suppose my time frame is a little bit more on the longer term side opposed to a short term sort of trade. The company I'm going to go for is Amazon. So it is in the selling stuff to consumers area. As you might have gathered, I suppose I'm not the greatest bear in the world that the stock market is ending and the world is coming to an end in the next sort of 12 months. So in that sort of environment, damn. I think it's a stock that's going to do well. I think under, you know, new management effectively, you're going to have a look at them trying to really focus on actually making returns in that retail sort of business. And as soon as they make money out of that retail side of the business, I think the shares are going to do incredibly well. So I think it's just a matter of time. I think some of the pain is already behind us. In fact, the vast majority of the pain, as investors, and ultimately I'm fairly bullish on its sort of medium-term prospects.
Yeah, and certainly maybe the pain of what's happened to their share prices has maybe introduced some rectitude in terms of what they should be doing in their business, focusing on margins and not just spending wildly. Shane, very quickly from you, what would you be picking?
So, you know, we're interested in a domestic mid-cap called Life Healthcare. They're one of the big hospital groups in South Africa. And the reason we're interested in it is we always look for companies that are decent businesses, decent quality businesses, on a reasonable valuation, but where there's some kind of embedded optionality in the future that you're not paying for at the present moment. And Life Healthcare has two businesses. They have a South African hospital group, which is about a third of the SA market, and they have a UK business called AMG. which is an imaging business. They do PET scans, CT scans, MRIs, and so on. Now, the current share price, in our opinion, you're only paying for the South African Hospital Group, okay? The SA hospitals are worth 16, 17 rand a share. The European business could be worth 5 to 10 rand a share on reasonable assumptions. So you're kind of getting that for free. And it's a structure of having assets in the UK and in South Africa that no one likes. And I think management are probably going to relook at this and find some way of separating those assets from each other. And if they do that, you will then get visibility on the value of the UK business.
Yeah.
So, you know, if South Africa is worth 16, 17 rand and the UK is worth 5 to 10, it's not easy, it's not hard to find sort of 50% upside in the share from you.
Yeah.
What we need are kind of sensible management interventions.
Yeah, and the catalyst. Right, well, lots of very interesting things to chew over this evening. Thank you very much to the both of you. Nice to chat to you. Nick Crail is from F&B Wealth and Investments. Shane Watkins is from All Weather Capital, and I'll be back with Stockwatch tomorrow night. Have a good evening.